I find myself in teaching leadership constantly trying to draw a picture for people of what a leader looks like. And the reason for that is that the clearer that I can define and the clearer that I can draw a picture of a leader for you, the better leader that you can become. When I was living in San Diego, between innings, they did this almost every Padre game, baseball game. On the big diamond vision, they would put just one part of a puzzle of a baseball player's face. And obviously, you would look at that one part of the puzzle and you wouldn't know who that player was at all. I mean, it wasn't enough of the puzzle put together for you to know. But what they would do is about every 5 seconds, they would add another piece of the puzzle. And after about five or six pieces, all of a sudden, there would be enough pieces of the puzzle till you knew who the ball player was. And I would watch the people as they would kind of just with real interest watch the pieces come together on the diamond vision. And when there was enough for everybody to kind of figure out who it was, all of a sudden, sometimes it would almost be audible. Everybody would say, ah, they figured out who it was. What I want to do is I want to put the pieces together of the puzzle to help you to look and understand what the picture of a leader is and just kind of really help you to when I'm done with this session, I want you to walk out of this room and say, I now know what a leader looks like. Now, let me give you a classic example of why I think this is important. When I was in India, in Calcutta, on one of the days that I was there, in fact, the last day that I was there, after I finished speaking, one of the things I requested for them to do was to take me to the grave of Mother Teresa. And I wanted to visit the grave. In fact, if she would have been living, we already had an audience with her. We were going to be able to spend some time with her. And so it was a great disappointment. My son, Joel Porter, went over about a year and a half ago to India, and I did get an audience with Mother Teresa with him. And his prize picture is a picture of the two of them together. Okay. We're at the grave of Mother Teresa, and I've got just the equipped people with me. And I looked at them. In fact, I took a picture by it with the equipped people. And as we got back in our vehicle to leave, I asked them a question. How could a little lady in such a horrible place influence so many people? It's a great question. I can promise you, if you're going to pick a place for there to be a person of influence and leadership, you would not have picked Calcutta. And you would not pick a nun in her 80s. Are you with me? I mean, what is it? What is it about Mother Teresa that made her a leader? Well, I mean, what does a leader look like? So anyway, it was at that time that my mind started asking these questions. And there are three common threads that I believe that are woven throughout men and women that throughout history have been leaders. The three common threads are, number one, a sense of destiny. I think that the great leaders have a picture of what they want, and they basically feel destined to fulfill it. There's a sense of destiny in the lives of great leaders. And they are able, not only do they feel it, but they are able to create it with the people that they lead. Now, that's very important. In other words, that common thread is not only in their life, but remember the attraction principle I've taught you before, we attract who we are. They not only feel a sense of destiny, but they're able to pass on a sense of destiny to the people that they are leading. The second common thread in the life of a leader is a sense of family. In other words, they have the ability to create what I call a supportive atmosphere, a sense of belonging. I'm very aware of this right now because we've moved from San Diego to Atlanta, 57 families. And last night we had our Christmas party at a wonderful place. And it was wonderful. And all I asked was not to do anything in the party except I wanted to have 15 minutes at the close to talk to the people. And it was so warm. It was so family. And at the close, I talked about it. I said, this feels good. This feels like home to us now. And we talked about community. And it was so interesting to watch the people. They could sense what I sense and they could feel what I feel. Now, here's what I mean. Leaders have the ability not only to give people a sense of destiny, they have the ability to give people a sense of family. And one without the other will not work. If you are destiny-oriented or significance-oriented, but have no bondedness, significance becomes hollow, because who wants to go achieve something without community? If you have community without destiny, you'll have a tendency to kumbaya and kiss each other all the time and do nothing. Isn't that true? So there is a tremendous balance, a sense of destiny which allows you to stretch, but a sense of community which allows you to feel. And then the third thing that I believe is a common thread among leaders is what I would call a militant spirit. Militant spirit, not in the sense of I'm at war spirit, but a militant spirit in the sense of that what I do is worth sacrifice, it is worth commitment, it is worth paying a price for me to achieve and get what I really want to become and do what I really sense I should do. Okay. Anyone that's an artist understands that there are primary colors that are used in a painting, basically red, yellow, and blue. And just as there are primary colors in a portrait, there are primary colors in a healthy, effective leader. So I've been challenged to ask myself, what is it in the portrait of a leader that are the primary colors or qualities that make a healthy, effective leader? And I'm going to give those to you now. The reason I'm giving them to you in the front is I want to talk about these four areas. But I want to give them to you in the beginning, and then we'll work through them. So the four what I call colors, primary colors of a portrait of a leader, are as follows. Character plus perspective plus courage plus favor equal healthy, effective leadership. Character plus perspective plus courage plus favor equal healthy, effective leadership. Now, to show you how these balance and how these are important, let's look at each one of them for a moment. Character is the infrastructure. Perspective gives you the insight. Courage gives you the initiative, and favor gives you the influence. Now, character talks, I'm going to break this down for you. This is going to be fun. Character talks about the leader's backbone. Perspective talks about the leader's mind. Courage talks about the leader's will. And favor talks about the leader's heart. So when we deal with character, we're dealing with discipline and responsibility. When we deal with perspective, we're talking about vision and faith. When we deal with courage, we're talking about commitment and risk. When we're dealing with favor, we're talking about people skills and charisma. Character is inward strength. Perspective is inward sight. Courage is inward spirit. Favor is inward skill. Character enables us to stand up. Perspective enables us to see ahead. Courage enables us to step out. And favor enables us to soar above. Now, as I put these things together, as a portrait or picture, I ask myself, what happens if I'm missing a quality? Okay? I'm saying, just as there are primary colors in a portrait, these are primary colors of leader, of which you cannot afford to do without any of the four. For example, are you ready? Character plus perspective plus courage minus favor equals no leadership. In other words, you could be a person of character, you could be a person that has good perspective, you could be a person that has courage, but if you don't have favor with people, you don't lead them because they're not going to let you. You don't have any influence in their life. So when you take the favor out of the equation, you don't have the ability to influence. Favor with people, favor with situations. When you take favor out, you lose influence. And when you lose influence, you lose leadership. Now, what happens if you have perspective plus courage plus favor, but you are minus character? Then you have, at best, unstable leadership. Isn't that true? Man, are they on today or are they off today? Are they going to do right or are they going to do wrong? So there's an unstableness in leadership when you lose character. Now, let's go on, because all of these ingredients have to be in the portrait of a leader. You take one out and you miss it, I guarantee you. Courage plus favor plus character minus perspective equals limited leadership. Limited in the sense that you cannot see very far, so therefore you can't lead very far. You lack vision. Favor plus character plus perspective minus courage equals short-term leadership. You know how long you'll lead if you lack courage? You'll lead until a problem arises. You'll lead until a situation that is difficult arises and you'll back from it. You'll cower from it. See, you've got to have all four. That's why it's a portrait of a leader. Just like the primary colors that make up a portrait, these are the primary qualities that make up a leader. And if you have all four, you're what you could be and what you should be as a leader. If you lack one of the four, I promise you, the picture isn't going to turn out right. You've got to have all four. If a person possesses only character, you have a good citizen. And we need those. But this happens to be a leadership course. If a person adds perspective to this, you have a wise person. If the person adds courage to these, all these qualities, then you've got an entrepreneur. But if you add all four, you get the flavor of all four, that's when you have a healthy, effective leader. Okay, so let's talk about these four different primary colors of the portrait of a leader. Are you ready to tackle the leader's character, first of all? As I went through this lesson and thought of a portrait of a leader, I thought of great men and women who had some of these qualities. A while back, I did a lesson called Lincoln on Leadership. Abraham Lincoln. When I think of a leader in character, I think of Abraham Lincoln. I believe the character of Abraham Lincoln saved the country. I believe it was his character that kept the nation steady enough to heal itself. So let's talk about character and what it means. Norman Schwarzkopf said, leadership is a potent combination of strategy and character, but if you must be without one, be without strategy. In your notes, Anthony Harrigan, the role of character always has been a key factor in the rise and fall of nations, and one can be sure that America is no exception to this rule of history. We won't survive as a country because we are smarter or more sophisticated, but because we are, we hope, stronger inwardly. In short, character is the only effective bulwark against internal and external forces that lead to a country's disintegration or collapse. Thus, the struggle to strengthen our national character is the most important struggle in which we can engage. Makes sense, doesn't it? By the way, when you think of character, you don't inherit it. You can't buy it. It's impossible to weigh, and you can't touch it. But you can build it, but not suddenly. When you think of character, it's the foundation of your life and my life. So let me give you some what I call character communicators. Let's talk about it just for a second. What you are, shout so loudly that I can't hear what you're saying. Number one, character communicates consistency. Consistency is birthed out of a life of character. Jerry West is with the Lakers, said you can't get much done in life if you only work on the days when you feel good. One time they asked Louis Armstrong what the difference between being an amateur and a professional was, as far as a musician. He said, an amateur is someone who plays when they feel good, and a professional is someone who plays no matter how they feel. I was interested, I was flying out here today from Atlanta. And typical me, I got my folder, and I've got, on this trip, I have 7 things to accomplish, of which I did 3 on the way out. I've got 4 more to do. And so, you know, if you got 7 things to accomplish, you got to get at it. So I've got them all in order in my briefcase to start working. And so I get on the plane, and I start working. The guy sitting beside me, I probably have worked for 2 hours. We've not said a word because, please don't misunderstand this, but when I get on a plane, I want to get some work done, and I really don't particularly care to entertain the troops. So I'm working, and I haven't said one thing. He's watched me for 2 hours, and he's been, I slept a little. He's been looking out at clouds a while. He's just been sitting. Finally, he looked at me and said, you're getting a lot done, aren't you? And I smiled. I said, well, I'm working at it, you know, and didn't want to get the conversation going, so I guess I am, and I'm back at it. So he didn't say anything for a few minutes, and he said, you know, I got some work I should do. I said, well, you know, we all have things to do, don't we? So I'm working a while, probably 5, never, you know, that's the way the conversation, about 5 or 10 minutes later, he said, you know, I just sometimes can't get myself to do it. And I said, like now. And he said, like now. He said, I just sometimes just can't get started. So he said, how do you get started? I said, here's my folder. These are things I got to do. You would have thought that I was unlocking a secret in this guy's life. Now, I would like to tell you after I showed him my secret that the guy says, well, now I'll get to work. He never did work. In fact, I was seriously tempted to ask him to do a little bit of my work because I thought if he could do one of these 7 things, he could check off something for me. But then I looked at him, I thought, I'm not too sure he'll do the quality I want. So I thought I'd rather do it myself. Now, all I'm saying, very simple, very simple. I planned 2 hours for this trip that I took. 2 simple hours. Just say, what do I have to get done? I did a growth lecture on the way out, a personal growth lecture that I'm going to give to our Enjoy people. And I had a whole stack of correspondence because I've been in meetings for the last 5 days that I had to knock out. On the way home, the first thing I'm going to do is I'm doing an Enjoy Life Club lesson on how to think. And my commitment on that lesson is to read nothing on it except go into my own self and talk about how I think. And then I've got to work on my calendar for the next 6 weeks as far as every day, every hour. And then I've got to do some reading that I've got on. Now, all I'm saying is out of the foundation of consistency is character or discipline. And it springs out of that. For your life, it springs out of that. For my life. I think I shared with you one time when somebody came up to me one time, well, it happens all the time, they'll say, well, I like to do what you do. And I said, well, you would like to do what I do, but you don't want to do what I did so that I can do what I do. It's very simple. Out of character comes consistency. The second thing is character communicates not only consistency, it communicates potential. Character gives great birth to becoming the person that you want to be. Because let me tell you something. You cannot become the person that you were intended to become if you do not have enough character to sustain you in the discipline of life to reach your potential. In 1983, I dug this out of my notes the other day. And I thought, I'll plug it in here for you. The more I live, the more I learn. The more I learn, the more I recognize that in our general makeup, people aren't really too diverse. We all have characteristics and personality traits that are unique to us, that they set us apart from everyone else. However, What I'm discovering is that there are really only two kinds of people in the world, whiners and winners. And whiners are feeling-oriented, and winners are character-oriented. And whiners feel good, and then they are what I call feel-good, then do-it people, where winners are do-it and then feel-good people. Whiners see it to believe it in people, and winners believe it, and then they see it happen. Whiners are controlled by atmosphere, and winners are controlled by attitude. Whiners are motivated by what happens to them, and winners are motivated by what happens in them. Whiners are responders, and winners are initiators. And John Morley was right when he said, no man can climb out beyond the limitations of his own character. Character communicates consistency. It communicates potential. Character, thirdly, communicates respect. When you don't have strength within, you won't have respect without. Again, I'm quoting Miller. He said, the only thing that walks back from the tomb when the mourners have been buried, after they've buried somebody, is the character of a man. He said, this is true. What a man is survives him. It can never be buried. Your character can't be buried with you. It communicates respect. Barbara Tuchman, in her book, The March of Folly, on George Washington said, George Washington had such character nobility that he exerted a natural dominion over others, together with an inner strength and perseverance that enabled him to prevail over a flood of obstacles. He made possible both the physical victory of American independence and the survival of the Republic. William Wilbur, in writing the book, The Making of George Washington, describes Washington at Valley Forge in the winter of 1777, said the winter was cruel, and it stalked the Continental Army like death. Terrible cold, bitter winds, exposure, lack of foods and provisions drove the Corps to the brink of starvation. Barefoot, hungry, nearly naked, the soldiers were sick, discouraged, and forsaken. Had they buckled and left their post, America would have been doomed. They could have returned home, but loyalty to George Washington allowed the men to stay on. And it talks about George Washington, how he took interest in their personal problems. He walked through the camp at night during the cold, talking with the soldiers. Their condition often moved him to tears. His relationship with his men was a glorious mixture of respect, loyalty, admiration, faith, and affection. And when he asked his men to endure suffering, they found it impossible to deny him. And I put at the end of this, when character is present in our relationships, everything else tends to fall into place. When character is present in the relationship. So the leader's character is so important in the portrait of the leader. Let's talk about the leader's perspective for a second. When I was in India, I wanted to test this. I just thought it'd be fun. So I talked to him a little bit about Martin Luther King, of course, and of course they think of Mahatma Gandhi and the independence that they got 50 years ago. And I said, Martin Luther King had a speech. I stopped, and all those people knew the speech, I have a dream. They knew it. When you talk about perspective and vision, here's an interesting thing. This century is almost over. Let me ask you a question. What person is it that you think has influenced in this century the world the most? Isn't that an interesting question? In the last 100 years, who's the person you think that has had the most influence? You know, narrow it down if you don't want to tackle the world. In America, in the last 100 years, who has had the most influence? It's just an interesting question. Every once in a while, I love to get in a dinner conversation with somebody and ask that question and just try to pull out from them. You know, I don't even know if I know the answer. I've got my opinion, but it's just an interesting question. I can promise you this. The person that had great influence
on this country or on the world was a person of great vision and great perspective. No doubt about it. Max Dupree. Have you ever read anything Max Dupree? He's written some good stuff. He says, the first responsibility of a leader is to define reality. And boy, isn't that key? The first responsibility of a leader is to define reality. In February, I turned 50, and I did a lesson in the Enjoy Life Club called I'm 50 and Reflecting. I talked about what you see at the age of 50. I mean, how you look at life differently. So I would like to, in this lesson, to give you a few perspective pointers. The first one is, what you are determines what you think. For example, if you're a leader, you think differently than followers. I don't mean this wrong. You think differently. Leaders don't think the same as followers. Followers don't think the same as leaders. So what you are determines what you think. If you are a follower, you think a certain way. If you're a leader, you think another way. Classic example, last year when we were still living in San Diego, we went up to the Rose Bowl parade and we had about four carloads of people, I don't know, maybe 14 or 15 people that are going to the Rose Bowl. And so we stopped on the way up at In-N-Out Burger. And I watched people get out of their car, their vehicle. And it was so funny because they all got out and they were just, we hadn't seen each other. And everybody's hugging and just having a good time out in the parking lot. And as soon as I get out of the car, I think, does not everybody understand that we all have to get into this restaurant and we all have to find seats? So, while everybody's hugging the parking lot, I immediately head for the door because I want to go find some, I got to find some seats. You understand? It just cracked me up. Making a beeline to the door was my son, Joel. 13 other people hugging in the parking lot. Joel's looking at him, very frustrated, and says, don't they understand? We got to reserve some seats in here. I was just cracking up. Leaders think differently than followers. Doesn't make right or wrong, but what you are determines what you think and how you think. Let me give you the second perspective pointer to think about. What you think depends on where you sit. What you think depends on where you sit. I love the cartoon. You probably saw it, Dennis the Menace. His mother's put him in the corner because he's been bad again, and he's in his rocking chair with his, with his teddy bear, and he's saying to himself while he's rocking in the corner being disciplined, he says, when I talk loud, it's called yelling, and when she talks loud, she's just raising her voice. Where you sit determines how you think. I love to play the game. I love mental games. I love the game. It's called Boggle. And I play not little Boggle. I play big Boggle. Let's get more letters. I love to play the game. What's amazing about the game is, you can sit and you've got the timer and you can write as many words that you can make out of this thing. And you think, I've exhausted this baby. All you have to do when the timer is over. There's a guy named Paul Nanny that I loved when I lived in San Diego. He and I would play Boggle by the hour. And I would think, I've got it. I've exhausted this. I've thought of every word I can get out of this. And then he starts reading his list. And he has words that I've never... And as soon as he says the words, I say, I see that. Oh, my goodness. In fact, if you really want to exercise, if you get out of your seat and you just go at another angle, and all of a sudden you see a whole other vein. See, where you sit determines how you think. And what you think determines where you sit. Now let me give you three. Number three, where you sit determines what you see. Where you sit determines what you see. Again, it's our position in life determines what we see. Don't you love King George III of England wrote in his journal on July 4th, 1776? Nothing happened today. Hey, where he was sitting, nothing was happening.
Right.
Outside of losing the war, nothing else. Now, when I communicate with people a lot of times, I'll ask them to remember moments. For example, if I talk to older people my father's age, they can tell you where they were the day they heard about Pearl Harbor being bombed. I mean, they'll tell you,
You know, where they were when they listened to the radio, the Pearl Harbor has been bombed. Some of you that are older, you're saying, yeah, I remember, I know where I was. Now, for people maybe a little bit more into my generation, you say, hey, where were you when JFK was shot? And in fact, it was so interesting because I was, you know, I had a lecture where I would do this, and Margaret was saying to me one time, she said, John, you've got to update your illustration. There's a whole bunch of people, they weren't born when JFK was shot. And so I said, well, I think you're right. So, hey. So I went to this one. Where were you when the Challenger exploded? Or for the music lovers, where are you when John Lennon was killed? When you heard that. Or hey, you know what the new one's going to be? What were you doing when you found out about Princess Di? Now, all I'm saying, this is a perspective lesson. All I'm saying is leaders understand perspective. And here's what, they understand that where you sit determines what you see. So what does a leader do? A leader understanding that is all the time asking, where are the people sitting? It's my job as a leader not to tell you where I sit. It's my job to find out where you sit. Because I can only lead you from your perspective. This is why perspective is absolutely essential. To cast a vision, the first thing you have to do is not only give them a preferred future, you have to go connect with something that they understand and that they relate to. There has to be a connection. And where you sit determines what you see. And all leaders, wise leaders, understand that. And so they always know where their people are, what period of life they are, their age. They take all of this into consideration. Now, one more thing on perspective. Let me review these perspective pointers. What you are determines what you think. What you think depends on where you sit. Where you sit determines what you see. And number four, what you see determines what you get. Harper Lee said, people usually see what they are looking for, and they usually hear what they are listening for. Heard a cute story about a guy from Colorado who moved to Texas, built a home. In that home, he had a big picture window where he could view literally miles of rangeland. And he looked out the picture window and he said, there's only one problem, there's nothing to see. And a guy from Texas moved to Colorado, built a home. Big picture window. Looked out the picture window and says, there's only one problem. He said, these mountains are in my way. I can't see anything. It's all perspective, isn't it? Huh? I filed this many years ago. This was a Dear Abby letter. It was written to her from somebody that signed themselves as depressed. So let me read it to you. Dear Abby, about a month ago we had a flash flood and I lost nearly all the treasures I have saved for 45 years. Albums filled with pictures and snapshots, letters, clippings, none of which could be replaced. And I had them stored in plastic containers. And when I opened them, all I found was mud and water. Part of my life is gone. I am heartsick over this. I am 60 and have had a very happy life. Our children are married and gone. And there are just now the two of us. And I've tried to keep busy and not dwell on my loss, but it is on my mind constantly. I wish I could forget this terrible nightmare. Somehow I feel that you can help me. Abby, have you ever lost any of your treasures? And if you had, how did you get over it? Signed, Depressed. Dear Depressed, Abby replied. Yes, dear. I lost my beautiful mother. In 1945, she was only 57. And a few years later, I lost my wonderful father. He was 62. And not a day passes that I don't thank God for letting me have my parents for as long as I did. I know many who were not nearly as blessed as I, and I think of those who have survived even a greater tragedy, losing their children. Now, what were you saying about clippings and pictures and other treasures? Perspective. Perspective. See, a leader sees not only from his or her perspective, but a leader sees from the people that they lead's perspective. You cannot lead people unless you can connect with the people and see them for where they are. Make sense? Let's talk about the leader's courage for a moment. When I think of courage, I suppose because I just came from India, I think of Mahatma Gandhi, who had such great courage in what he led in the resistance movement there. In your notes, leadership requires courage, the courage to risk, to reach, to put oneself on the line. The word courage itself comes from a French word, cœur, which means heart. Thus, leaders must have the heart for the task of working and engaging others. The real leader's heart somehow speaks to the hearts of those around him or her, inspiring and touching them. I decided on the courage to take a moment and go inside myself. And I pulled out my legal pad, and I just decided to write down the times in my life that I've had to display more courage than what I had in my own reserve. And I became very surprised. I did this exercise in 3 minutes. I thought, okay, now I got to think of the time when I was courageous, when I had more courage than what I thought I would have. And you know what I found out? I found out that my moments that I needed to call on courage were very, I could go back to them very quickly. So let me take you on a 5-minute journey. It won't mean a lot to you, but it'll mean a lot to me. Okay? Let me just take you on a little journey. Because when I graduated from college, I graduated from college, and 2 weeks later, I married Margaret. 2 weeks later, I went to my first church. Okay. There was a church in Maysville, Kentucky, that was a wonderful church. They wanted me to be their pastor. And they offered to pay me. Now, you got to understand, this is back in 1969. They offered to pay me $240 a week. And I mean, I thought, whoa, this is awesome. Now, I didn't go to that church because when I got there, I realized that there was a lot of politics and a lot of power struggle there. And I knew I was a kid, and I knew that I wasn't ready to handle that. So instead of going there, I went to Hillham that paid me $80 a week. And I can remember Margaret saying, but you know, we could have got 3 times more money in Maysville. And I can remember really making what I considered back then a huge courageous decision for a kid, that I would always look for what I considered to be the best opportunity, not the one that would always provide me with the quickest return. And I made that courageous move to go to Hillham instead of Maysville. And then the temptation came because the board said, you can't make enough money here, so you can work on the side. You know, you can kind of pastor part-time. And I remember Margaret I can still remember her standing up at a board meeting and saying, he is going to be the greatest pastor in the world. Only 20-year-old people can say things like this. And she said, and your wife. And she said, he's going to work full-time here, and I'm going to work. She was a school teacher. She taught kindergarten half day. She worked in a jewelry shop, and she cleaned houses on the weekend. And she said, I'll work full-time so he can work this church full-time and build this church the way. And I remember I looked over and I thought, man, I thought I made a courageous decision to come to this church instead of it. But man, I got a wife who made a huge courageous decision. I can still remember telling her, Margaret, if you'll do that for me while I build this church, there'll be a day I'll take care of you. And I've been trying to pay her back ever since. I really have. A courageous decision. I can remember standing in front of the congregation after I'd been there for 12 months and apologizing to them because I had made a horrible mistake in my leadership. And I remember asking their forgiveness. And I remember the courage I had to muster up to go out and face people and say, I didn't do this right, and I was wrong, and would you forgive me, and would you give me another chance? And, of course, those wonderful rural farming people, I can still remember, I learned something that day, and that was that if you'll just admit that you don't do it right and you'll just be open with people, that they'll respond and come to your side. And, I mean, they rallied to my side. They rallied to my side quicker in my failure than they did in my success. But I remember the courage it took for me to just stand in front of them and say, I blew it. I did not do this right. And then I remember when I was invited to my second church in Faith Memorial Lancaster. This church, I was 25 years old. This church was the biggest, most prestigious church in the denomination. And I was 25. And I thought, whoa, if I go to this church. You know, in Hillham, the good news about pastoring in Hillham, nobody ever saw you. So when you messed up, nobody really knew, except the people you messed up with. I knew when I went here, when I messed up, everybody would know. I remember the going through the whole process. Am I ready to take the risk? And then I remember when I said, I'll do that, I remember had to confront the kind of the negative lay leader of the church that was always the negative fighter. And I can remember, hey, he was 65 and I was 25. And I can still remember the day we had to sit down and I had to confront him. Oh, I'd rather gone to hell. In fact, kind of thought I was there a little bit. And then I remembered that I didn't know much. And as I realized that I had to get out of my circle to learn. And so I took a huge risk. I said, okay, I got to go find other people that do it better than I do it. And I went completely out of my comfort zone. And I began to go to other organizations and other groups that were better and faster than me. And I knew they were. And I kept telling Margaret, I said, I've got to go learn from them. And I remember taking a whole bunch of flack by getting out of kind of the zone that I was in. And then I remember making commitments in evangelism. And then I remember trying to change a church that was full of tradition. And then I went into a building program when I was 27, my first multi-million-dollar building program. I mean, I don't know anything about building. To give you the right perspective, the nursery in the building program that the church I was building, the nursery was bigger than my church that I first pastored, size-wise. And I remember that just... I'm over my head so much, and I'm just... I remember walking around... The building, just praying, asking God to help me. And then I remember the first time I did a church, when I was 28, they asked me to do a growth conference, how to grow your church. And I remember I'm 28 years old, and I'm sitting there and I'm thinking, there are guys that are 50 that ought to be doing this. And I remember how intimidated it was. So I said, I'll do the conference, but I won't speak. You find that hard to imagine, don't you? And I didn't. I brought in, fact, you'll love this. Sometimes you talk to Elmer Towns about this, because he was one of my speakers at my first conference. And I wouldn't speak. I put everybody else up. And I'd introduce them, and everybody said, why didn't you speak? I thought, well, because I'm 28. I mean, I don't know what I, you know, who. And I remember the courage. The next year they said, well, in fact, Elmer Towns said, John, you've got to speak at your own conference. You've got to get up and tell them what you're doing and how you're growing this place. And I mean, at that time, the church is, I don't know, probably, I'm 28, it's probably running 1,500, 1,800 people. And I'm saying, but I'm just a kid. Nobody's going to listen to me. And I remember the courage I had to go through that. And then I had to leave the denomination I was in. Oh, my goodness. And then the whole process of following the founding pastor of the next church. 27 years, the only church pastor they ever had. And I mean, people said, John, don't even touch that. You'll get killed. And I remember, okay, here we go. I'm going to follow the founding pastor. And then I had to go in my church board. Oh, the first year... I had to begin to develop the board, and it was a political thing, and I don't even want to get into that. I don't even want to talk. I mean, every day I put my job on the line, literally. I mean, any day I was expecting Margaret to call Martin and say, hey, call U-Haul. You know, because I really was on the edge. As I began to change them, then I had to change my whole staff. And I said I would do it in 3 years. I mean, when I went, every pastor on staff I knew didn't have the ability to take the church to the next level. So I said, I'll let a third of them go the first year, and a third of them go the second year, and a third of them go the third year. And the stories of just knowing that I had to make decisions that are not easy decisions to make, and how am I going to let them go in that whole process. And then to relocate the church. And then I had to, Lloyd Ogilvie asked me to write Deuteronomy, the commentary of the Old Testament, one of the books of the Old Testament. He asked me to write Deuteronomy for Word, for a commentary called the Communicator's Commentary. And he said, John, I want you to write Deuteronomy. You got to understand, everybody else that was writing the books of the Bible commentaries were in their 60s, and I was 29. And to do Deuteronomy right, you have to know Hebrew. And I took Greek in college, but I didn't take Hebrew. So I had to hire a Hebrew professor. And so I hired him, and he had come down and teach me Hebrew. I mean, you can't even, I'm writing this Deuteronomy commentary. I want to quit so bad. I would ask God to let me quit. I'd ask Margaret to let me quit. I mean, I thought, I'm never going to get this project over. for 2.5 years, I sweated through writing Deuteronomy. I mean, I was so far over my head. Now, all I'm saying is, in life, there's just a whole bunch of things that we do have to have courage. Then I had to raise dollars for property that we didn't even have zoned. And I remember that they told me not to do it. Then I said, okay, I want to start ISS. And then I was going to resign Skyline. And then I was going to move to Atlanta. Here's what I'm saying. I sat down, and in 3 minutes, I just could think of dozens of things that I did. Now, let me tell you something. As I'm giving you my little journey of courage for a few moments, every one of you, if we could stop right now and you could get your legal pad out, you could start talking about the decisions you've had to make, the tough decisions I'm talking about that have made you as a leader. In fact, here's what I'm convinced. The only decisions that grow you and stretch you are the decisions that take courage to make. Most leaders want the perks of leadership, but they don't want to pay the price of leadership. Boy, that's true in my life. But it was those courageous decisions. So when I talk to pastors about how to let a staff member go, pastors look and say, how in the world can you do that? Courageous decisions. Those tough decisions that you just that make you as a leader. So let me give you some comments on courage, just to put in your notes right now. Number one, courage is contagious. It's an absolute fact that when one person exhibits courage, other people pick it up quick. Number two, courage is doing what you are afraid to do. When I came in the John Wayne Airport today, I thought of the quote, courage is being scared to death and saddling up anyway. Huh? Number three, courage is the power to let go of the familiar. Wow. The ability to let go of the familiar. It's the ability to stretch yourself out of the comfort zone. Not out of your gift zone, but out of your comfort zone. Number four, courage is belief in action. The only measure of what you believe is what you do. If you want to know what people believe, don't read what they write. Don't ask what they believe. Just observe what they do. Number five, courage. I love this. By the leader encourages others. In other words, with courage comes encouragement. Number six, you don't even have to write for this one. I figure you'd be getting tired by now. Courage takes the high ground and seizes that which is essential for growth. Bankers Trust has a great quote, risk surrounds almost everything worth having. My friend Larry Osborne, who lives just down the coast, a wonderful friend. In fact, I miss having lunches with him. So the most striking thing about highly effective leaders is how little they have in common. What one swears about, the other warns again. But one trait stands out, and that is the willingness to risk. Just came across this poem by James McMantry. It's entitled Painting by the Numbers. You're painting by the numbers, connecting all the dots, and you work from the neck down. You can't even call the shots. You jump when they say jump, and you don't even ask how high, because painting by the numbers, you know that you'll get by. The courage to get out of the box, paint out of the numbers. One more thing, character plus perspective plus courage plus favor equal healthy leadership. Let's talk about the leader's favor for a moment. Thomas Jefferson, wow. In his 20s, had such favor with our country, he drafted some of America's earliest and most important documents. What great favor he had. By the way, this was the hardest part of the lesson, this last part. Because when we talk about a leader having favor, it can become very mystique. So I began to say, what are the flavors of favor? If you have favor with people, what does it mean? Well, number one, it means influence. People that have favor with others have influence with others. But there's another word that I like. in the word favor. It means choice. In other words, it's a fact that the leader chooses to be with the people and the people choose to be with the leader. There's a choice element in favor. It's not something that is assigned or designated or appointed. The third word is a great word for favor, and that's specialness. Favor comes out of the word favorite. In other words, there's a relationship in these words. And when you have favor with people, they have a special place in your heart. You have a special place in their heart. When you have favor with your people, there is a specialness in that process. For all of my nieces and nephews, I have nicknames for all of them. And they love their nicknames better than their names. So for my sister Trish, she has two girls. One's Rachel and one's Jennifer. And Rachel's always been Angel to me. I just call her Angel. I never call her Rachel. I said, come here, Angel, let's talk. She loves that name. And she just, when I talk to her about being Angel, her face just lights up. She goes, whoa, whoa. For my son, Joel Porter, he's always been my number one son. For Elizabeth, she's the apple of my eye. I mean, I'm just talking about just nickname that just show specialness in their life. Jennifer, my little niece, I call her Sweet Pea. Hey, Sweet Pea. I mean, she loves it. Favor means specialness. Number four, favor means relationships. It means loving people, which basically precedes leading them. A leader has favor with people, has a close relationship with them. Favor with people, number five, means extra effort. People that we favor, we have a tendency to give a second chance. We tend to go the second mile. There's one more word, I think, in a leader when you talk about the favor of a leader. Having favor with people in your business. And this word is probably more mystical than any of the other ones, but when I looked at it, I thought, I've got to include it. And that's the word calling. I believe that the best leaders have a calling to what they do. And there are some words that fit into my calling. And some of them will fit into yours, some of them won't fit into yours, but look at yourself and say, do I feel that I'm a person that has a calling, a mission, a purpose to do this and start this? The first word that fits into my calling is knowledge. I've always known that I'm supposed to do what I'm doing. Do you know how much fun it is to always have known? The second word is focus. I can do nothing else. I can do nothing else. I'm focused on it. The third word is passion. If you have a calling to do what you not only can do nothing else, you want to do nothing else. The fourth word is personal. It's who you are. You can't separate basically what you are and what you do because it's so much a part of your life. The fifth word is giftedness, because what that calling is, you do it so well. And the last word is favor. There is a favor that comes in a calling until what you do, you know that you not only do it well, but you know that God helps you to do it. Let me close with this story and then we'll wrap it up for the day. On the portrait of a leader. Probably the last 6 weeks up until I came back from India, those last 6 weeks have been the most pressing 6 weeks of my life because of just a lot of traveling. And right before I left for India, I was in Syracuse, New York. Unbelievable. We had a leadership conference. Syracuse, New York is a tough area, especially in church circles. And what happened in Syracuse was just unbelievable. I left that conference saying leadership has never been better than what it is now. I left on a high. And then I went to India. And when I went to India, I thought, can I teach these leadership principles across a culture? Will they be able to grab hold of them? I can tell you, to watch them grab hold of the principles. One thing I was teaching them in India was the fact that as a leader, and in fact, I did a visual illustration of this. I brought one of them up there, and I said, as a leader, if you push people down, you go down with them. And I took a guy that I had up there, and I had him clear down on the floor. I mean, I've got him. I said, if you just keep pushing people down, you've got to go down with them. You can't push people down and stay up. And I'm laying on the floor. I mean, these Indians are clapping, they're cheering. And I said, but if you pull them up, every time when you raise them up, obviously you have to stretch and you go with them. And they caught. I mean, I just did visual illustration after visual illustration, and they were going wild. And I remember doing that whole process saying, this is so much fun. This is so much fun to connect with people of a whole different culture, but watch them as they begin to, they grab hold of the visual principles of leadership. And then when I came back last week through Equip, one of the things we're wanting to do is to go into inner cities and teach leadership. And so they brought in 45 to 50 leaders from Black leaders from Chicago, Miami, Houston, Dallas, Atlanta, some of the bigger cities of the United States. And for an afternoon down at Chick-fil-A headquarters in Atlanta, Georgia, I taught leadership to some wonderful people in leadership positions. And again, it was incredible. I connected, and it was life itself to me. Now, here's what I'm saying. When you do what you love to do, and you know that you have favor with God and with people, there's an energy that you get that just keeps you keeping on. People don't even understand it unless they are a part of the process. It's what I call favor with people. Now, there are four things we talked about a leader. We talked about a leader's character, perspective, courage, and favor. Of those four qualities in your life, which one is the strongest of the four? Which one is the weakest? If you could scale them down, which do you do well and what do you do not do well? What is it that you just say, I think I do well here. I think this is an area that I need to work on. Now, you can't do without any of the four. Some will be stronger than others. Shore up the weak areas. Begin to work on them. Hold yourself accountable to someone else. Bring somebody around to help you. But here's what I know. The better you improve those four areas, character, perspective, courage, and favor, if you can take those four areas and paint your picture with those four colors, you'll be the leader that God intends you to be.